The body of a slain German exchange student has been flown from Missoula back to Germany. Good evening, I'm Madeline Beck.
And I'm Connor Ballantyne, and that's our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
Flathead reporter Katrin Fry looks at why the state Fish, Wildlife, and Parks Department is thinking of raising fees. And in our feature interview, news director Sally Mock talks with a nonprofit fundraising expert about the challenges nonprofits face in the wake of shrinking government funding. The father of a 17-year-old exchange student shot dead in Missoula departed the U.S. today after criticizing the nation's gun culture and arranging for his son's body to be flown back to Germany. Chalal Didi flew out of Missoula after securing the release of Deeran Didi's body, which was transported from Montana yesterday afternoon, according to German consulate spokeswoman Julia Reinhardt. Before he departed, Chalal Didi told the German news agency DPA that he had never imagined his son could be shot for simply entering somebody's property. He said, quote, "America cannot continue to play cowboy." Marcus Karma on Sunday fired 4 blasts from a shotgun into his garage, killing Deeran Didi, who was inside. He faces a charge of deliberate homicide. It's not clear what the teen was doing in the garage. Prosecutors allege Karma shot into his garage without warning after Didi tripped alarms.
And in other news from around the state, the special prosecutor in Barry Beach's 1984 murder trial says the case has been exhaustively reviewed and the State Board of Pardons and Parole should reject Beach's recent clemency application. Beach was sentenced to 100 years in prison without the possibility of parole for the 1979 killing of Kim Neese near Poplar. Both were 17 at the time. Former Governor Mark Roscoe wrote to the board Tuesday. That same day, supporters of Beach argued that young criminals can no longer be sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole under a 2012 U.S. Supreme Court decision. Beach is seeking the opportunity to be paroled after serving 30 years in prison. KCITV reports Roscoe argued Beach has sought clemency 3 other times, and there have been no changes in circumstances to support a 4th attempt.
Federal officials say more than 36,000 people in Montana selected insurance plans under the nation's health care overhaul law by the March 31st deadline. That exceeds health officials' original target of signing up 31,000 Montanans by the end of the open enrollment period. The Department of Health and Human Services released the data today. The department says 55,675 people in Montana completed applications and were eligible for coverage. Of those, 39,572 were eligible for financial assistance, and 4,638 were eligible for Medicaid of the Children's Health Insurance Program. A total of 36,584 people selected plans in the state. Of that number, 53% are women, and 31% are between the ages of 55 and 64. More than half chose the second lowest silver plans out of the 4 levels of coverage.
Hunting and fishing license fees need to go up, and maybe it's time to find a way for non-hunters and anglers to pitch in on the costs of wildlife and land management in Montana. Those are some of the findings of an advisory council created at the request of the governor to look at ways to keep fish, wildlife, and parks out of a multi-million dollar budget shortfall. Flathead reporter Katrin Fry has more on what these recommended changes might look like.
Every 10 years, Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks goes back to the drawing board to look at fees, license costs, and its budget. Administrator of Communication and Education Ron Ausheim says FWP typically requests fee increases from the legislature at these times. Ausheim says without a fee increase, redirected funding, or budget cuts, the agency is facing a $5.7 million shortfall by the end of 2017.
It takes about a year and a half following legislative action, assuming they do approve some changes, to actually start seeing the revenue. That's why we're doing this now. We're solid through 2017 because of some budget cuts and some additional federal funding that we use to replace license dollars. We just aren't in good shape after 2017. That's why we're going to the people now.
Ausheim says 65-70% of the department's revenue comes from hunting and fishing license fees, almost 2/3 of that from non-residents. $300,000 of general fund money goes to FWP, earmarked for aquatic invasive species programs, and the rest comes from excise taxes. He says from this budget, FWP is handling everything from hatcheries to enforcement to the cost of gasoline.
We've got issues with endangered wildlife, endangered fish. We've got issues with gas prices. I mean, it's kind of all over the place, and There are sometimes some of these responsibilities are added by the legislative body, and many of them are, and that's how the system works. It just takes money to operate.
The state director of FWP put together the Licensing and Funding Advisory Council at the request of the governor. The council came up with a series of recommendations after looking at the fee structure for the past 8 months. In a nutshell, it came up with the creation of a $10 base hunting license you would buy before any other licenses like elk or deer. Second, general fishing license costs would increase from $18 to $24. Third, Ossheim says it recommended standardizing discounted youth, disabled, and senior licenses at 50% of the cost of the general license, and increasing the age for seniors from 62 to 67 years old. Finally, the committee recommends the state look at additional revenue options outside hunting and angling licenses.
All Montanans and visitors benefit from the management activities associated with this agency, and they're funded largely by people who purchase hunting and fishing licenses. Now, those that who do not purchase a license, they benefit in other ways, and they also have some impact on management. The group said, hey, let's take a look. They didn't make any recommendations. They said, hey, our charge was licensing. We do think, though, that that needs to be addressed.
Ossheim says the committee was made up of people representing various fishing, hunting, business, and government interests.
These are recommendations of a private citizen group advisory council that was appointed. All we did was provide information.
None of these recommended changes would go into effect until 2016. FWP is holding a series of public meetings about the recommendations across the state through the month of May. The first is tonight at 7 p.m. at the Doubletree in Missoula. A complete list is available on our website. The meetings are informational and provide a chance for the public to comment on the potential changes. From there, FWP will make a recommendation to the governor and the Environmental Quality Council, and legislation could be introduced into the next session. Katrin Fright reporting from the Flathead.
Stillwater Mining Company officials say they are offering buyouts to up to 50 hourly union workers from its mining operations in south central Montana as part of an effort to cut $4.3 million in costs. The Billings Gazette reports CEO Mick McMullen made the announcement during a conference call with investors today. The buyouts follow the layoffs of 35 salaried non-union Stillwater employees last week. Union officials reported the layoffs, but the company would not confirm them until today's conference call. The company reported $19.6 million in earnings for the first quarter of 2014, or 15 cents per diluted share, up from $14.6 million a year ago.
Much of the discussion of climate change focuses on the dramatic changes going on in the Arctic and northern climates, but University of Washington biologist Ray Huey says we should be worried about the tropics, too. Huey's research specialty is evolutionary physiology, and he has been studying the effect of climate change in tropical areas. The news is not good.
The models currently suggest that by the end of this century, with very high probability, the average temperature in the tropics will be warmer than anything that has ever been experienced to date. Let me repeat that. The average temperature at the end of the century will be hotter than the highest temperature ever recorded in the tropics. That means it's a new world, that the organisms there will be facing temperatures that are warmer than anything they have ever recorded to date. I find that extremely scary.
Huey will give a free public lecture on another of his research topics, Himalayan mountain climbers, tonight at 7 o'clock in the University Center Theater on the University of Montana campus. We'll have a feature interview with Huey about his climate change research next week during Montana Evening Edition.
The Commissioner of Political Practices has found that one of his predecessors violated Montana campaign practice laws. But Commissioner Jonathan Modell says there's no way to enforce today's decision against David Gallick. Gallick was commissioner from May 2011 to January 2012. During that time, Gallick signed a tax form as a treasurer for a political group called Council for a Sustainable America. Modell says Montana law prevents the commissioner from participating in any political activity. Gallick says he was not involved in any political activity. The group had ceased operations in 2010, and he simply signed the final tax return. Modell says the law prohibits even the appearance of conflict. He says he can't seek penalties against Gallick because the one-year statute of limitations has passed.
The deputy director of the Department of Labor and Industry has been named the executive director of the state agency that manages its public pension systems. Lee Newspapers of Montana reports Dor Schwinden will take over on Monday as head of the Montana Public Employee Retirement Administration. The MPER board announced the hiring yesterday. Schwinden's salary will be just over $109,000. Schwinden succeeds Roxanne Minahan, who agreed to retire as long as the state pays her pension and health insurance premiums through 2015. She's expected to step down next month. Schwinden has served as deputy commissioner in the Labor Department since 2013 and also held the post from 2005 to 2010. He was director of the Commerce Department from 2010 to 2013. His father, Ted Schwinden, was Montana's governor from 1981 to 1988.
What's being billed as Missoula's largest collaborative community-wide charity drive kicks off next Tuesday morning just as the clock strikes midnight. Give Local Missoula is a 24-hour online giving event from 12 a.m. midnight until 1 minute before 12 a.m. May 7th that will connect the greater Missoula area with community nonprofits. The goal is to raise $100,000 for 90 Missoula nonprofits during that brief time. Noreen Humes is the Downtown Community Development Manager for the Downtown Missoula Partnership. That's one of three entities that have teamed up to advocate for the benefit of and ongoing improvements to the downtown area and its master plan. Hume says local nonprofits are closely connected with the community.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you've been here for any amount of time, you know that Missoula is an extremely giving community. We are a can-do community, and, you know, basically if there's any kind of big project going on or fundraiser, Missoulians show up for sure and are very generous.
A local and national fund will enable opportunities for matching funds.
So if, for instance, for us, the Missoula Downtown Foundation, if we raise, say, 2% of the total amount that's given during that day, then we'll get 2% of that matching fund. So it's divvied out between the nonprofits depending on how much is given. So if you give a dollar, then it's matched by a dollar. One of the things people need to know is that to be considered for that matching fund, you have to have $25 minimum donation. So basically, you know, if you give a dollar, you don't get the matching dollar. But if you give $25 and up, then you get those matching funds.
Drop-in donor lounges are also being organized.
You can obviously give during this day in the comforts of your own home on your own computer, or you can go to any computer in Missoula, say at the library, and donate online. But a donor lounge is, say you're out walking around for lunch downtown and you want to stop in and do your donating at that point. You can go into, say, the foyer of the Florence building, which is one of our donor lounges, and you can give online there and talk to someone and do that. We also have a donor lounge at the Missoula Downtown Association office on Main Street, and you can come in and get a treat and a drink and donate online.
Visit givelocalmissoula.org for more information.
Visitors will be able to travel through the east, west, and north entrances to Yellowstone National Park starting tomorrow. Park officials say many popular park destinations, including Old Faithful, the Grand Canyon of the Yellowstone, Norris Geyser Basin, and Fishing Bridge will be open, although visitor services will be limited at first. Avalanches could still cause periodic closures of the East Entrance Road for the next several weeks because of deep snowpack above Sylvan Pass. Vehicles will not be able to stop on the pass because of the slide potential. Entrances to Grant Village, West Thumb Junction, and Craig Pass to Old Faithful are set to open May 9th if weather cooperates. The road from the north entrance to the northeast entrance remains open all year.
As government funding shrinks, nonprofit organizations are depending more and more upon private donors. Those organizations are also increasingly competing against each other from a pool of donors that may itself be shrinking. Kim Klein is an author, publisher, and consultant who works with nonprofits to help them meet their fundraising challenges. She's in Montana this week for some training with nonprofits in Missoula, Helena, Kalispell, and Billings. Klein says the cuts in government funding are an impossible gap to fill.
One of the things that I really encourage nonprofits to do, which is separate from the fundraising training that I provide, is to teach themselves and teach others what constitutes fair and just tax policy, and to advocate for that, and particularly to advocate that the government do its job. The government has a job, And then private nonprofits have a job. And you know, when everybody does their job, there's a little more balance. But right now, we're seriously profoundly out of balance.
And how would that tax policy help nonprofits specifically?
Well, specifically, for example, nonprofits would go to Helena or would advocate at the federal level for restoration of government funding or sometimes even for increased government funding. I mean, I don't know Montana very well, but in California, we have no public schools. In the tradition that I grew up in, the public schools are all public-private partnerships. The parents raise money for music program, art program, library, increasingly even sports, is all provided by fundraising. And, maybe that's the right way to run a public school. I don't really think so. But the fact is we never had a conversation as a community. Wow, do we want to have public schools that are half funded by parents? And then the parents that can't raise the money or that, you know, whatever, those schools get worse and worse. Do we want that? Is that what we mean by public school? Or do we want a public school that's funded by the public? And I think you see that with public parks, public health, all that kind of stuff. And nonprofits are the place where public and private kind of come together because we're often doing work in the public interest and on behalf of the public that's not for profit. But what's happened is government funding has shrunk. We've agreed, as a friend of mine says, to do more and more with less and less. And then he said, what will we do? Everything with nothing? I mean, that makes no sense.
So one of your pieces of advice to nonprofits is become more politically active.
Yes. And yes, absolutely.
At the same time, government funding is shrinking. So is the middle class.
Yes.
And that's a big donor base for many nonprofits.
Oh,
it's
yeah.
It's probably the donor base, isn't it?
Well, you know, you have in the United States, the surprising thing I think to a lot of people is that 7 out of 10 Americans give away money. And 70% of the adult population, and that includes immigrants as well. People come from other countries with their own giving traditions. And, of course, a large number of those are middle class. A large number are working class. But as the middle class shrinks, yes, we do have a situation, and you see it everywhere, where you have, let's say, just on the left and the right, if we were to use those spectrums, the Koch brothers on one hand or Tom Steyer, George Soros on the other, flinging millions of dollars at their various campaigns, and then common ordinary people who think, well, should I give $50? But does it really make a difference? Because all I'm reading about are these multi-million dollar campaigns. And so we do see a shrinking number of people giving away money. We don't see a shrinking amount of money being given away because it's being filled in by these
super
mega
rich
people. But mm-hmm. This comes back to your comment about government. You know, because we're increasingly moving into a very medieval patronage society where every single thing that we need, ordinary people to function, we have to hope that some generous person picks it up privately. And I think that's very corrosive to our democracy.
That segues into what I think has become a common fundraising tactic by nonprofits currently, and that is hoping that someone rich will give them money. And I'm talking about the new focus on, quote, major gifts.
Yes.
What do you think of that?
Well, you know, I've always been a big fan of major gifts. So, you know, if you read my stuff, I'll say, yeah, you should really try to find people who can give you large amounts of money. But I feel like what happened to that, and that's, you know, that's not original with me. That's very traditional. But I feel like what happened to it is somehow it, you know, got on drugs or something, and people just went nuts with it. And, I think it's a very big problem. And it means a lot of organizations are heavily reliant on maybe a handful of foundations or a handful of individual donors. Those donors, even if they don't mean to, wind up exerting a lot of power, it's a problem.
It's funny you say that in the wake of the Donald Sterling scandal, the Clippers owner who is clearly a racist,
yes,
who gave tons of money to the NAACP,
yes,
and they became somewhat beholden to him, and now are having to disavow him. That's kind of the worst case example, I suppose.
Yeah. I mean, that's a real extreme example, and we can only hope it's more rare. But there are a lot of times where a donor will, you know, exert power, say, I'd like to see this happen or I'd like to see that happen. And I think sometimes even let's move away from Sterling and move to someone who's maybe more good, you know, genuinely wanting to be helpful. They say something and they're just saying it, but the organization hears it with this huge power behind it. And so the organization might think, well, that's not such a good idea, but they're very unwilling to say that to the person. And so, a lot of ideas wind up getting enacted that I don't think the donor was that and cared that much about, but the organization wouldn't confront the person.
Do you think on the whole, Kim, that nonprofits are as accountable and transparent as they should be to their donors?
On the whole, yes, I do. I absolutely do.
That's another issue that comes up sometimes.
It does come up. And there are these very famous bad charities. And unfortunately, they're very famous, iconic bad organizations like in more recent years, the Penn State or the Boy Scouts or the Catholic Church and things like that. And, you know, so that's shaken people's confidence. He's like, if you can't trust them, how am I going to trust your little bitty group? But I think that really we are fairly regulated. You know, if people really want to know much about nonprofits, I encourage them to go and look at the Nonprofits 990. Every nonprofit has a
– That's a financial
– Yes, it's a financial form. But, you know, and sometimes you'll say they're – it's hard to wade through it. But in fact, you can easily find out things like how much is the highest paid person paid, who are the top donors, and, you know, what's the income and expenses. And I think, you know, my feeling about most nonprofits, again, on the whole, is that most of them actually squeeze every nickel. They don't pay very well. They rely on the unpaid labor of volunteers. And they're really quite extraordinary. And that we hold up a huge that if you imagine a day without nonprofits, that most communities would just fall apart.
Missoula would lose a lot of population. Which brings up my next question. Are there too many nonprofits? Are there too many groups out there spreading the shrinking pot too thin?
You know, that's a question that I get a lot. But are there too many? I don't think that's really quite the question. The question is, the real question that would give us the number of nonprofits we need is for the whole community to come together and say, what kind of community do we want to be? And when people drive in here, what do they expect to see? A museum, a gas station, a fire station, a public hospital, a good public school system. And what of those things should be funded by government? What should be funded privately? What can be public-private mix? What can have some corporate element? How do we want to manage ourselves? And those big meta conversations we don't have. And we do have them in other countries. Finland has them, Norway, Canada. They have those big conversations. And consequently, I think they have the right number of nonprofits. And it might be the number we have now. The problem, the real elephant in the room that the number of nonprofits raises is that if you look from when I was first in fundraising in the early 80s, there were 750,000 nonprofits in the United States. Today, there's 1.5 million. So if you were to graph that over those years, 80, you know, 1980 something to now, and you'd see this huge rise, and you were to graph the rise of social problems, drug addiction, poverty, child abuse, infant mortality, you would see that those problems have risen. Well, technically, if we have so many rising nonprofits, we should see actually a line going the other way. Now, did we cause that? Absolutely not. I would fling myself under a bus to say that we didn't cause it, but we didn't cure it. And that's the conversation I think we need to have. Why haven't we been able to see a concomitant decrease in social problems with the rise in the number of nonprofits that there are?
Speaks to effectiveness, for one thing.
Yes, it speaks to effectiveness. It may speak to awareness of the problems. It's possible that we became much more aware of the problems. It may speak to community kind of, you know, pulling away and letting other organizations handle it. I mean, any number of things. But until we have that conversation, we're really nowhere in this, in solving the problems.
Well, I have been speaking with Kim Klein, who is a trainer, author, and publisher, and expert on fundraising for nonprofits. Kim, pleasure to have this conversation. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Now for tonight's forecast. West of the Divide tonight should be partly cloudy with lows in the mid-30s to lower 40s. Tomorrow calls for partly cloudy skies with highs in the 70s. In central Montana tonight, look for mostly cloudy skies with isolated rain showers and lows in the 40s. Tomorrow should be mostly cloudy. Rain showers are likely with highs 55 to 65 degrees. In southwest Montana tonight, it should be partly cloudy with lows 35 to 45 degrees. Tomorrow, look for partly cloudy skies with highs 65 to 75 degrees. And now for the editorial comments of Colin Marshall.
This year's frigid temperatures have been a stark reminder of the importance of reliable and affordable electricity for families in Montana and across the nation. For many, the electricity that heats homes and keeps the lights on comes from coal produced in southeast Montana. Coal remains America's single largest source of electricity. The Federal Energy Information Administration projects that coal will be the country's leading electricity fuel for decades to come, as currently there are no alternatives that can produce large-scale, low-cost, reliable power in the way coal does. It is frustrating that opponents of coal are able to propose that moving quickly from coal is viable without having to explain the massive economic impacts this would cause through rapidly rising electricity prices. Europe has tried this experiment and is now increasing its use of coal. Even the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change projects that the world's use of coal will increase, led by growing electricity demand in Asian nations. This is why Cloud Peak Energy actively supports the development of carbon capture and sequestration technology that will allow carbon dioxide from coal and gas power stations to be captured and stored deep underground. Cloud Peak Energy is proud to be one of Montana's largest job providers and taxpayers. We operate Montana's biggest coal mine, the 18 million ton per year Spring Creek Mine, which is located near the Wyoming border in southeast Montana. In 2013, Cloud Peak Energy paid $260 million in taxes and royalties, of which $55 million went to the state of Montana. For the same year, our corporate income totaled $52 million. To give some perspective, Cloud Peak Energy's 2013 total coal sales of 89 million tons supplied approximately 4% of the nation's electricity, enough energy to power around 15 million U.S. homes. While America's electricity demand is projected to be stable for the next few decades, there is a tremendous opportunity to increase production from Montana to export to growing Asian markets. Cloud Peak Energy's logistics business currently exports over 4 million tons of coal a year from our Spring Creek mine to U.S. allies in South Korea, Japan, and Taiwan. According to the International Energy Agency, Asian coal imports are projected to increase by 65% over the next 30 years as those countries build state-of-the-art coal plants to power their growing economies. Montana is in a great position to benefit from that increased demand, having high-quality coal close to West Coast shipping ports. However, existing ports are at capacity, and additional terminals need to be built to allow Montana coal to be exported to Asia. You may be aware that well-funded environmental groups have been working hard to frustrate and delay new terminal development. We are confident that any legitimate concerns regarding rail traffic and coal dust can be addressed, but are well aware that opponents of terminal development are much more interested in stopping coal exports than in ensuring they are executed responsibly. Stopping port development would impact Montana's ability to grow its economy and create jobs and generate tax revenue. A University of Montana study found that if the Spring Creek mine expanded by roughly 50%, 1,500 new jobs would be created, both at the mine and in the wider community. $60 million of additional economic activity would occur, and more than $50 million in new tax revenues could be generated. Utilizing the state's coal reserves would cause investment in infrastructure that would aid the state's entire economy, not just coal. These are big impacts that will not happen without new ports. In addition, Cloud Peak Energy has option and exploration agreements with the Crow Indian tribe, covering more than 1 billion tons of the tribe's coal. If even a small portion of their coal were to be mined, it would bring significant benefits to the tribe's people by providing well-paying, stable jobs and significant tax revenue. Coal is a vital part of the nation's electricity portfolio and will remain so for the foreseeable future. Moreover, coal is an important export commodity in high demand throughout the world that is going to be used increasingly by developing nations. If Montana does not supply the growing Asian export demand, the coal will come from other countries. Montana has a tremendous opportunity to supply some of that demand and to benefit from the jobs and investment in the process. I am Colin Marshall, President and CEO of Cloud Peak Energy. Through the Spring Creek Mine, we are proud to be part of Montana.
Colin Marshall is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed don't necessarily represent those of this station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Madeline Beck.
And I'm Connor Ballantyne. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.